Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. I really didn't know if I'd make it to a fifth episode. I figured with my track record I'd have probably gotten bored by now, but apparently not, so here we go. I'm at 100 downloads now, which I suppose isn't the greatest, but I guess for a beginning podcast with only 4 episodes, I guess that's alright. I also seem to have picked up a few international listeners from Ireland, Austria, and Switzerland. This week, we'll stay outside the borders of the United States again, this time traveling to equatorial Africa. The belief in a man taking on the attributes of an animal is one of the oldest superstitions in the history of mankind. Whether it be the sympathetic magic charms that allowed a hunter to take on the attributes of a predator, the sort of shamanic lycanthropy that allowed a magician to actually project his consciousness into a pre-existing animal body, or the more literal lycanthropic transformations that most of us are probably familiar with, that allowed a human to actually physically transform into an animal. The means may vary, but the effect is much the same. The Viking berserkers were probably the most famous to use the more mystical forms of lycanthropy, donning their bear skins to gain the powers of a bear. It's often said by many that berserkers could be bears or wolves, but technically the wolfskin wearers were known as Alfhethnar, and not berserkers. So, now you know. Sometimes the tales included their actually physically shifting shape, but usually it was the more mystical form. Early forms of outlawry. An outlaw, originally, was a person sentenced, essentially, to rough it in the wilds for his crimes. Early forms of outlawry practiced by the peoples of Nordic and Germanic extractions mentioned that the outlaw was to be treated as an animal, and it was essentially seen as open season on his life. This forced outlaws to live a nomadic existence in caves and other forest hideaways. It also made the forests, understandably, a dangerous place to be. You had not only wild animals, but you also had to deal with outlawed murderers. The earliest versions of English common law in the Middle Ages actually referred to outlawry under the name caput lupinum, let his be a wolf's head. Now, I wonder to what degree this sort of bestialization of a violent people influenced our perceptions of werewolves.
What sort of man would kill like a leopard and leave the traces of a leopard?
Crazy guy.
He'd have to know about leopards. Have access to leopard claws and hair.
I had always been under the impression that leopard men was a singular entity. But on researching this episode, I found that, like the Hellfire Club from last episode, there were actually several groups of leopard men with different roles and associations. The origins of the first leopard men groups seem to have been among the Bantu peoples of the Cross River area in Africa, the Cameroon-Nigeria border region. Here they're referred to as Anioto, from Nioto meaning scratch. The Congolese leopard men were mainly heard of from the 20s into the 50s. They seemed to be by and large a peaceful group, although doubtless opposed to the colonial government, which was Belgian in this case. One encounter sometimes in Africa, where the pathology is more dominant than elsewhere, curious cases of delirium where the patient imagines himself to have metamorphosed into one of the animals feared by the population. Tribes and families placed under the protection of the animal, to which they imagine themselves to be blood-related, live in this belief that runs in a certain way through their veins and arteries. This quote, which is from Father Joseph Christen, somewhat contradicts the fact that the belief in lycanthropy was an absolutely enormous one in Europe. Now, he was probably referring to extant ongoing belief, whereas most serious belief had already died out in Europe. But still, this quote serves to reinforce the traditional European mindset of the time, of seeing themselves as more advanced than the Africans. Another member of the clergy, a Reverend Anderson, wrote in 1850, "He assured me that it is so strong a law that no man may break it. Wishing to know the penalty, I asked if Ekpe would kill him. The reply was he will chop him down to nothing. That is, he will forfeit to Ekpe all that he possesses." The word Ekpe, which he uses here, is the word for leopard. That's another commonly used term for the leopard men. Interestingly, the leopard men are often referred to simply as a leopard, and the differentiation between the men and the animal doesn't seem to exist. The meaning of the leopard skin and false claws used by the leopard men was debated. While some believe that they could physically take on the form of a leopard, some believe that they gained the power of a leopard, in a parallel to the Norse berserkers discussed earlier. It was often seen as merely a disguise to ensure anonymity and avoid recriminations for the punishment they enforced. Murders did occasionally occur in the meting out of the justice the leopard men undertook. It was noted, however, that the populace was supportive of the prisoners, bringing them food and other goods while they were imprisoned. These leopard men, after all, were of the peasant hero archetype. In the 1930s, by contrast, it was recorded that some of the leopard men of the Congo were implicated in a number of political assassinations. Now, interestingly, these leopard men were referred to as Wahoko Hoko rather than Anioto, like the traditional leopard men, which serves, in my mind, to drive home the separation between the two and the feeling that these were not the same group of people. The Wahoko Hoko were described as specialist assassins hired by prominent chiefs to further their ambitions, exact revenge, extract tribute, or exert coercion during inter-clan conflicts. The leopard men, as they existed in the West African nation of Sierra Leone, were a bit more ruthless, and if the listener is familiar with leopard men, these are probably the types of leopard men that you've heard of. It's almost useless to examine the leopard men, though, without first looking at the Poro. The Poro Society was a secret society whose aims sound sort of familiar. Writing in 1822, Major Alexander G. Lang described them: "Palavers of great weight, such as disputes between rival towns, or offenses of such magnitude as to call for capital punishments, are always settled by the Poro, the headmen of towns not having at the present day, whatever power they may have possessed formerly, the lives of their subjects or dependents in keeping. The Poro may therefore be said to possess the power of general government of this country, and from the nature of their power and the purposes to which it is applied, they will probably be found a most serious obstacle to its civilization." By this description, the true aim of the Poro seems to be nearly identical to that of the leopard men of the Congo. In fact, Thomas Aldridge writes that another name for the Poro is the Society of the Law. K.J. Beatty in Human Leopards says unequivocally that all leopard men are members of the Poro. So this essentially is a secret society within a secret society. Now, the Poro are known to function this way with societies within societies, so this is actually to be expected. So, were the leopard people of Sierra Leone merely a corrupted branch of the Poro, sort of like the mob enforcer who takes too much pleasure in his work and becomes a killer? Researcher David Pratton apparently believed this was the case, for he wrote, that in contrast to these groups, however, which stood for the social reproduction of the community, the human leopards were antisocial and stood for the accumulation of selfish individual power. Bishop Ernest Ingraham wrote in 1894 that the Temnes believe that by witchcraft a man may turn himself into an animal, and in that form may injure an enemy. A man was burnt at Port Loco in 1854 for having turned himself into a leopard. Beatty mentions that the Temne often criticized the special commission investigating the leopard men of Sierra Leone, saying that it was absurd to waste so much time on prisoners, but that we ought to burn all the persons charged with human leopard offenses, together with their villages and families. G.A.L. Banbury, in his 1889 book, Sierra Leone, or the White Man's Grave, don't mince any words there. Why don't you tell us how you really feel, Mr. Banbury? Writes that in the Mende mission, they possessed the skin of a large leopard with iron claws, which had once been the property of a man who, under this guise, satisfied his horrible craving. Furthermore, there were a number of cannibals burnt in the lands of the Mende tribe in Imperi province, and a number of Tongo players were summoned in order that the other cannibals may be discovered. Tongo players were a group of roving witch finders. It seems that they were very much in the Matthew Hopkins, "You're screwed if you're even accused" mold. According to K.J. Beatty, the ordeal for the accused was the plunging of his hand into a cauldron of boiling oil and pulling out a piece of hot iron. If the hand was burned, it was certain proof of guilt. If not burned, of innocence. So, in other words, no one was ever innocent, because that's plainly impossible to not burn your hand doing that. The Tongo were led by a man named Kpowomo Anopo, whose reputation was such that if he had to pass through a country where there was a war, the people would actually stop fighting to allow him to pass. Beatty goes on, "A huge fire was lighted, and the Tongo players were directed to throw into the fire all persons whom they found to be cannibals. One of the first to be cast into the flames was the principal chief who had been instrumental in calling the Tongo players, and it is asserted that as many as 80 persons were burnt to death, a number of them anticipating their fate and of their own accord throwing themselves into the flames. In response, on May 5th of that year, a proclamation was issued by the British colonial government banning the Tongo players and exiling all current members." Now, this may have been the impetus leading to an upsurge in activity by the leopard men of Sierra Leone, to the extent that a few months later, the government also made it illegal to possess a leopard skin or the three-pronged knife, which was usually known as leopard nails or Mavara Ekpe. The leopard men were reputedly not only cannibals, but witches. The same proclamation also made it illegal to possess a magic item called Borfima, which we'll describe in a moment. Later, it became apparent that there was also a group of crocodile men, similarly attired in crocodile skin rather than leopard skin, and the proclamation was amended again to make possession of a crocodile skin illegal. In July 1912, a murder took place in Imperi. The murderers were disturbed at their work. A man who was patently concerned in the murder, but was not one of the actual murderers, was arrested. Upon this man's shoulders, the murderers threw the whole burden of explanation. Unable to invent even a plausible explanation, he made a clean breast and gave the names of those implicated in the murder. In the course of his explanation, other murders were referred to, and other names were mentioned, with the result that further arrests were made, whilst other members of the society whom he named turned King's evidence. This situation led to the launching of an investigation to root out the leopard men. In December 1912, a young boy named Kalfala, the son of a chief, was killed near the village of Mongeri after he disclosed some members of the Poro. Eventually, he was seen being murdered by someone in a leopard skin outfit. Three people were arrested for the murder, and one of those proved to be Kofala's own father. Two witnesses admitted leopard men, who testified before the court, disclosed that they were pierced with a needle, and the blood taken from the wound was put into the Borfima, which was a sort of medicine bag possessed by certain members of the society. The bag was filled with eggs, human blood and fat, chicken's blood, and a bit of rice. Its purpose was to make him rich and powerful. It will make people hold him in honor. It will help him in cases in the white men's court. And it certainly has the effect of instilling in the native mind great respect for its owner and a terrible fear lest he should use it hostily. It was said that obtaining blood and fat for the rejuvenation of the Borfima was the primary aim of the Leopard Man murders. Around 1910, another group, known as the Baboon Society, had become known in the area of Port Loko. As K.J. Beatty describes the events leading to the revelation of the society,
during the month of May 1913, a small girl was killed near the village of Bow Camp, and according to statements made by persons who turned informers, she was murdered by members of the Human Baboon Society. Their statements were to the following effect: that this society was formed about 6 years ago and consists of 21 members made up of 11 men and 10 women. That 7 victims, all young children, had been provided at various times for the society. That at their meetings, one of the members of the society dresses himself in a baboon skin and attacks the victim with his teeth. That the spirit of all members of the society becomes centered in the person who is for the time being wearing the baboon skin, which when not in use is kept in a small forest where it is guarded by an evil spirit, and that the baboon bites pieces out of the victim which the other members of the society devour.
We move 30 more years into the future and east into Nigeria. Under the heading Murder at Ikot Okoro, Leopard alleged, the Nigerian Eastern Mail reported on March 10, 1945.
Leopards, or human leopards as some suspect, have been waging a relentless war on the people of this division, particularly those living in the Ikot Okoro area. Again and again, the people have appealed to the government for help. They have wailed for a long time, but no help has been forthcoming. Day after day, reports are made of loss of several lives due to the ravages of these ferocious animals. Nobody knows what government thinks of this state of affairs. Recently, the houseboy to court messenger Okon Bassi was attacked and killed while on his way to tap palm wine near a riverside. The people are like sheep without a shepherd.
The murdered man was named Dan Adafia. Despite the assertions made in the article and generally held by the populace, the medical examiner was convinced that it was a man and not a leopard responsible for the injuries inflicted on Adafia. After 10 days' investigation, none other than Okon Bassi, Odafia's boss, was arrested for his murder, along with two other men. It was very mundane-type circumstances, because it turns out Okon Bassi was having an affair with Odafia's wife and wanted him out of the way. And that's the most mundane thing ever. Once again, implications of leopard men began, and though they were skeptical of their involvement, the British began an investigation.
The epidemic of men-leopard murders in the Abak and Opobo divisions has naturally caused government great worry and concern. Whatever may be the root cause of this outbreak of wanton barbarity and savagery, it has been aggravated by the lack of police supervision caused by the reduction in the police force during the war. It is suspected in some quarters that conservative and antisocial elements influential in the tribal life of the areas concerned are using the evil society as a sort of Ku Klux Klan to terrorize womankind and check any tendency to greater social freedom on the part of the women of their communities, especially in view of the tendency of the native courts to give women greater facilities in divorcing unsatisfactorily husbands than had traditionally been allowed them.
In 1946, It was reported that a man, called only Abraham, was traveling around selling what he called leopard medicine. Abraham's medicine was said to impart the strength of a leopard to the user and allow him to be undetectable in action. Some of the Nigerian testimony came from a man named Ekyet, who told of how the leopard men brewed their magical compounds and then killed. The leopard men were supposed to brew the compounds in a special pot, which they called Abang Utam Ekpe Owo, or Pot of the Leopard Men's Work. The pot was buried in the ground with only the top sticking out, so as to create a sort of well. Underneath the pot was a mortar and pestle, and underneath that was buried a human skull. The pot contained leopard claws, eggs, certain types of leaves, water, palm wine, and a bit of soil from the grave of a dead sorcerer. Into this was thrown another leaf on which was written the name of the victim. The leaf of a raffia palm was also dipped into the mixture. It was said that by doing this, and then spraying some liquid from the mouth at a certain place, the leopard man could magically lure the victim to that place, where an ambush would be laid. Then, by means of flicking the dipped palm leaf at the victim, they would render them insensible, a state in it which was known as enom, or not knowing oneself. It was described rather as like being drunk, and they could then be killed without incident. When a leopard man was accused, something called Afia Akpong Unam Ata Ekpo, or refuse to trap a criminal spirit, could also be brewed that would assure his acquittal. The Nigerian leopard men seem to have not really disguised themselves. They didn't don the full leopard skin outfits, but usually merely a simple mask, a spotted cloth, or actually most commonly of all, no disguise at all. The investigations ran until 1948. By that time, 96 had been arrested as leopards, and a full 196 murders were blamed on the society. They concluded overall that it was unlikely that there was a central organizing body directing the activities of all groups, or a chief leopard man, but rather that this society was decentralized and that village cells operated more or less independently of each other. Armed with this model of the secret society, it was supposed the society spread occurred in two phases. First, by authentic leopard men who employed all the various devices to disguise their acts. And second, by those who affected crude imitations of the leopard man style. The later phase was thought to have seen the formation of the so-called imitative societies, in which little was known of the original ritual, apart from the method by which a murder could be passed off as a killing by a leopard. Another group of theriomorphic killers were the Lion Men, or Mabojo, from Tanganyika. Over 300 deaths were laid at the feet of the Mabojo, both in their initial wave of activity in the 1920s and a later one in 1946 and 1947. Their exact identification was unclear, whether they were men dressed in lion skins, shapeshifters in the truest sense, or, as was the most prevalent explanation, that they were actual lions controlled by witchcraft. It was reported that a witch would, for 15 to 30 shillings, send a Mabojo to kill your enemies. One man arrested had claimed that he transformed a girl into a lion with hashish, and then hired her out for 30 shillings. How hashish can be used to transform someone into a lion, I'm not sure, but that's what he claimed. The types of enemies assassinated encompass the most mundane and pedestrian types of victims. A woman who wouldn't sell someone beer, debtors, and inattentive husbands. The lion men presented rather a different situation than did the leopard men. Though many Mabojo were named in the trials, which had assumed the guise of witch trials more or less, none were ever apprehended. Almost all the names that were given were children that had disappeared years before and never been found. Vicky Van Bokhaven, says that these Mabojo were likely more a group of what are termed social bandits. Think like Robin Hood and his Merry Men, or the archetypical peasant hero, or the outlaws we discussed at the beginning of the episode. In short, not much different than how the Anyoka were seen. The Leopard Men have certainly had their effect on popular literature, appearing in Tarzan novels, the comic book Tintin, and the novel Black Alibi, which was filmed as the Leopard Man. In Man-Eaters of Zamboula, one of the Conan stories by Robert E. Howard, the Sumerian finds himself in the proto-African city of Zamboula, whose streets are stalked at night by cannibals of Darfar, who file their teeth into sharp fangs, and I suspect that they may be based on the Leopard Men to some degree. Furthermore, I'd argue that the men put into the swamp by voodoo man Saul Stark in another Howard story, Black Canaan, could similarly be based on the little documented crocodile society. The Leopard Men still exist in a modified form, and one which owes more to the original Anyoko than their murderous inheritors. A group known as the Abakua can be found in Cuba, begun by Bantu, transported to the Americas during the slave trade. Even some of the mystical incantations used by the Leopard Men in ceremonies can be heard in certain Cuban jazz. And in Elliot O'Donnell's Strange Cults and Secret Societies of Modern London, although given O'Donnell's general reputation, this was likely mainly, if not completely, fiction, he places a lodge of Leopard Men in that city. Coincidentally, in the Shooter's Hill area, where in the 1960s there were actually a number of panther sightings. A tantalizing section of Jorge Luis Borges' Book of Imaginary Beings concerns a number of Tigre Capiangos, or werejaguars, which served in the forces of General Facundo Quiroga. The Tigre Capiango is another name for what is usually referred to as a Yaguarit Aba, or Indian tiger. Most mention of Quiroga using these came from the writings of José María Paz, who was a notable enemy of Quiroga. And I always find this kind of demonizing, in this case almost literally, of one's enemies to be a bit questionable. Quiroga was already a very much a larger-than-life character. He was reputed to have killed a puma when quite young, and for this he was referred to as Tigre de los Llanos, the Tiger of the Plains. Because many of Quiroga's men were likely rough-looking plainsmen and farmers, I'd imagine it was easy for more metropolitan folk to give them animalistic, bestial attributes in an attempt to dehumanize them, since Quiroga was the enemy. Quiroga's Capiangos were likely nothing of the sort. And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, @gmail.com. And so, until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.